This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 28th of May on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we see the emergence of Turkey's design scene over at New York's annual design week, ICFF.
Unlike most places, like Turkey still has the craftsmen, not from school, but from generation to generation being handed down.
Back in London, we attend another design fair, Clerkenwell Design Week, and ask if the youngster might have come of age.
Materials, techniques, poetry, there's so many aspects that come into a piece of design. It's hardly ever, if it's something that is working super well on a technical level, it still needs some poetry as well, and it has to be part of our time.
Meanwhile, in Helsinki, we get to the heart of Finnish fashion at the launch of a new initiative called Pre-Helsinki.
I think we are kind of just scared of being out there, in a way. But I think that's changing with young Finns' minds.
Elsewhere in the show, we attend a very special exhibition of the craftsman that Hermes uses. We sit down with creative director of Taiwanese mobile phone brand HTC. And we talk the future of packaging with Blaise Bertrand, industrial design director at IDEO. That's all to come over the next hour, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Turkey has a rich craft heritage, but until recently Turkish industrial design has received little attention by comparison. All that's changing as the country becomes more integrated into the global design culture. And during New York Design Week last week, a group of Turkish designers gathered to show off their creations, bringing a dash of the Bosphorus to the banks of the Hudson. In New York, Shepard Lachlan reports on the emergence of Turkey in the global design world.
New York Design Week features a sprawling array of events and installations scattered throughout the city. But Wanted Design, a curated selection of works from more than 80 exhibitors, stands out from the crowd. Laid out along a narrow passage with high ceilings and exposed brick, it's a convivial space that facilitates chance encounters between established figures and up-and-comers. In other words, it's the perfect place to be if you're trying to make an impression.
My name is Doğa Kayalar. I'm with the American Turkish Society. This is the first time that Turkey is being represented at during New York's official Design Week. Collectively, we have seven display items from nine Turkish designers. We just saw that there was a niche. There was an important niche that this was not done. There's not been a group representation and a sort of collective representation.
If anything links the designers gathered here, it's an interest in Anatolian tradition, coupled with a fluency in the language of international design.
Hi, my name is Can Yalman. I'm from Istanbul, Turkey. And I represent Can Yalman Design. We're an independent design firm in Istanbul. I graduated from New York. I went to Parsons. But after my graduation, I went to Turkey, and I've been there for the last 20 years, and never actually came and exhibited here in New York.
Yalman's contribution to the show is a Turkish tea set with a contemporary twist.
It's a very traditional pastime in Turkey. Everywhere you go, you drink tea, and there's a lot of ceremony involved, how it's produced and how it's consumed. And usually, the design of the glass is a narrow-waisted design. So once you see that, you instantly recognize it as a tea glass. And we wanted to take a different approach. So it's usually a very curved, soft belly. We took that and we gave it a faceted edge, a different look, a different edge to it. We also wanted to amplify the how the water, the tea or liquid in a glass distorts what's inside. So when we have the teaspoon, that's also faceted, so that it looks like it's broken apart, just like the glass itself.
Design duo Muse is composed of Aaron Turkoglu and Melody Bozkır, who recently graduated from the industrial design program at Brooklyn's Pratt Institute. Their entry at the show, Novella Vessels, is a range of stackable tableware produced using a technique called slip casting.
My name is Melody Bozkır with Muse Design.
I'm Aaron Turkoglu, and we're Muse.
I've been a part of the Turkish American Society since I first moved to New York when I was a kid, because my dad was always involved. And I used to always see them supporting fashion design and this and that. And when I heard they were supporting industrial design, I got so excited, because I feel like it's a new thing for us.
And it's really getting big in Istanbul as well. It's really growing really fast very recently.
Despite the vitality of the New York design scene, they've taken their practice back to Istanbul. Last October, the first ever Istanbul Design Biennial took place in the cosmopolitan neighborhood of Beyoğlu. The theme was adhocracy, loosely defined as collaborative, spontaneous design, independent from top-down bureaucracy. Early this month, the adhocracy show was transplanted to New York's new Museum of Contemporary Art. The Muse designers were at the inaugural edition in Istanbul.
It was great. We were there. We did some of the workshops there.
And adhocracy one.
It was very crowded. It was very crowded. Got a lot of attention. People were definitely, it raised awareness. I mean, it was all over Istanbul. It was a great organization.
And the concept of autocracy really related to Istanbul life, which was kind of perfect for the city, for the spot, the concept. It all like started this movement of valuing uniqueness over mass production kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's a lot of, unlike most places, like Turkey still has the craftsman, not from school, but from generation to generation being handed down. And
it's really, really deeply rooted and really old crafts.
Across the hall, food designer and chef Dilara Erbay is preparing a performance. A recent transplant from Istanbul to New York, she'll be collaborating with mixologists from Brooklyn to make cocktails based on three kinds of love: sinful, divine, and romantic. Erbay explains her methods while fellow Turkish designers gather to take a break from the bustle of wanted design.
For sinful love, I would have lots of aphrodisiac. We will have a divine love, so I will play with coconut. And then as a Sufi, I like to also give a reference to our Anatolian Sufi mystic side. Also, we will have a romantic love where we will play with rose, which is also very oriental. And at the same time, DJ Memos would be mixing oriental sound with Brooklyn sound. So we're gonna party and feel a bit oriental chemistry.
Back over at the Turkish design booth, designer Kore Özgen has some final thoughts on what he's gained from exhibiting in New York.
New York also is a hot spot of design, especially in May. So I live in Paris as a Turkish designer. Also I follow Paris or London or Milan, but I think in New York is another
different
substance of perceiving things. The visitors like coming are much more direct, asking direct questions, sometimes more sincere questions, whether they like or not. And that's for me is the most important part as a designer, to get some feedback, direct feedback. And I exhibited before in New York too, so this direct feedback of New York visitors I really appreciate. It's a good feedback for me.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Shepard Laughlin.
Thank you very much for that, Shepard. and from one design week in New York to another on the other side of the Atlantic. Once a fringe event for London locals, Clerkenwell Design Week is now a firm fixture on the international design calendar. With more architects per square mile than anywhere else in the world, Clerkenwell has built up a thriving design community, who happily opened their doors for 3 days last week to a wide range of exhibitions, debates, product launches, installations, and a few parties too. Hazel Pfeiffer took a whirlwind tour of this year's highlights and hidden gems.
Even with the distinct presence of international brands and designers, Clerkenwell Design Festival still feels local. With everything packed into a few square miles, it's surprisingly easy to get around the many venues and rub shoulders with design talent, both homegrown and international. It's also a chance for this talent to put their heads together to come up with creative solutions to some rather pressing challenges.
Climate instability is with us now, it's not in the future, and it is going to throw up a whole new set of challenges that all of us, I mean, not just architects, not just designers, have to deal with.
Architecture Foundation Director Sarah Ichioka was a speaker at Waterworlds, a talk by 100% Design on construction and habitation on water. In the wake of increased flooding across the world, Sarah told me how a new attitude to designing in and around water could change the way we live for the better.
Reconsidering our relationship to water in a positive way, not something that we need to shut out, or indeed we should have illusions that we can shut out, but actually something that needs to be welcomed back into our cities, for example, through the use of landscaping. Tom spoke about the London Olympic site. One of the more positive aspects of that was actually the recreation of wetland close to natural approximation of the original bank conditions of the River Lee. And I think it would be really interesting to see more urban waterways using landscape at their edges.
The panel included journalist and broadcaster Tom Dykoff, the Royal College of Arts Dean of Architecture Alex de Rijk, and Adam Hiles from Doug and Morris Architects. Adam explained to me the concept behind his recent floating cinema project, based in Lee Valley in East London.
Well, we were really interested in the idea that the canal offers a completely different way of exploring the capital from the road and rail networks that we all know. The fact that you're lowered down into a kind of alternative route through the city that completely ignores these other means of getting around gives you a unique perspective of the city. It allows you to see places that you thought you might otherwise know from a different point of view. It allows you to uncover places that you didn't know necessarily existed. And furthermore, it allows you to see and visit communities of people, examples of kind of rich social and kind of cultural fabric of the city in ways that you wouldn't necessarily otherwise get to do.
Amongst the many designers presenting new collections or ideas at the festival, Dutch designer Ineke Hans brought a touch of playfulness to the table.
Playful is a difficult thing because I think we shouldn't make just playful objects and make funny gadgets. That's what I'm against. But I do believe that if things have kind of twists which makes it recognizable in your mind, we have a playful mind, we know when there's games played with our mind. And if we can touch that as designers, that's already a part of entering people's heart with an object.
I joined her for a breakfast of chocolate sprinkles on bread, a traditional Dutch treat, at the Arend showroom to hear about the solving of design conundrums.
You know, if I'm looking at designers solving puzzles, it's about solving a puzzle with a lot of aspects to the pieces. It's about beauty, it's about technicalities, it's about economics, it's about materials, techniques, poetry. There's so many aspects that come into a piece of design. It's hardly ever, if it's something that is working super well on a technical level, it still needs some poetry as well. And it has to be part of our time, and it has to deal with the world we're living in. And all these things you have to put into this puzzle, that's what I like.
The festival is also a chance to explore some of Clerkenwell's many historic buildings. The Museum of the Order of St. John, part of which dates back to the 12th century, housed an exhibition with a difference.
So this exhibition is based on the surrealist technique called cadavre exquis, or exquisite corpse. You start a drawing, you hide it, someone else continue, you hide what he has done, someone else continue, and you end up with a very surrealistic drawing. And we have decided to transpose this technique to the design world.
Curators of the exhibition, Geraldine Vessière and Florian Dussop, established a chain of interpretation, where each designer created a piece inspired only by the previous designer's work. The resulting pieces by Plant and Moss, Dominic Wilcox, George Oler, and Matthew Plummer Fernandez cross the spectrum of design practices, techniques, and materials. Dominic Wilcox told me his first reaction to the lung-shaped lamp by Plant and Moss that was to be his inspiration.
I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? No, but yeah, I looked at the lamp. It was a ceiling lamp, and I really wasn't sure. But then after thinking, I thought, well, you know, why do we only put light bulbs in lamp holders? You know, can we put anything else? Because it's an electrical connection, so you can connect anything, really. And I just quite liked the idea of putting some music player in the centre of the room, in the ceiling. So that's how I had the idea of turning light bulbs into radios and, well, in this case, a ghetto blaster.
As co-curator Florian Dussop explained, this kind of lateral thinking across design disciplines was central to the exhibition.
So basically, our point with this exhibition was to explore the diversity of design and to see all these people with some practices so different. But they are all about design and something with digital 3D printing and something doing beautiful object for the interior or some other object more thought-provoking like the ghetto blaster on a desk lamp. Everything, all of this is part of the same practice. The methodology, as you can see on the blackboard, is not too far from each other. Everybody has his own inspiration, but at the end, it's still part of design. And people are coming to the exhibition, getting attracted to one of the objects, depending on where they come from, either more architect or more experimental, more digital. And then they start to ask questions and start to read the full story toward the other object that they are less familiar with. And through this story, they really understand that they're all linked together.
With fluid solutions and floating cinemas, dynamic Dutch design and exquisite corpses, Clerkenwell Design Week is a celebration of the wealth of creativity unique to this central London locale. From Monocle, in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
Thank you very much, Hazel, for that. Coming up, we'll be talking to Claude Zellweger, Creative Director of HTC, after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Claude Zellweger is the creative director at Taiwanese mobile phone company HTC, which has just scored a big critical success with its latest flagship, the HTC One. It's been admired for the full aluminium back cover, striking camera, and an elegant user interface. Our technology correspondent David Phelan talked to Claude Zellweger about mobile phone design, what you need from a camera, and the importance of innovation. He asked first how long the HTC One took to design compared to HTC's usual one-year gestation.
I would say the process was a bit longer on this one because we initiated the whole thinking around the technology that we would apply specifically on the housing about 18 months before. So that's when we decided that we would take a bit of a course action or change in course for going from all plastic construction to back to a unibody in aluminum. And so that really required for the advanced materials team to dig a lot deeper and sort of do research on the side while we were developing the ideas for the actual design.
It's not the first nearly all metal phone that you've made. The HTC Legend obviously was mostly metal. What were the lessons you learned from the Legend that helped you design the HTC One, or was it more of a voyage of discovery because it was so different from that?
It's interesting that you say that, because the Legend, while it was a great step forward for us, and we put a stake in the ground as being experts with metal, we also felt that we had to make too many compromises in hindsight. We had to make too many cutouts for antennas, and so we then subsequently moved on to a plastic unibody, which was for simplicity's sake, just having one part. But in the meantime, we were able to progress technology to the point where we could do a metal unibody with integrated antenna technology and gave it that completely seamless look that we were striving for on the 1X, meaning that now we're able to really implement what we wanted to do on the Legend in the first place.
There's often features that are appearing in phones which seem more like gimmicks than anything else. I know you're involved in much more than just the hardware design. How crucial is it that you get those innovations right and make sure they're things that people really want to use?
Yeah, I think you're touching upon a really good point here, because what we're looking for is to come up with very relevant areas of innovation, and we can bundle a lot of ideas into very simple new experiences. For the camera, for instance, we looked at how people really use their smartphones, and it's over 90% of the people now use a camera, or the phone as the camera, excuse me. And so I think for this particular occasion, it was extremely important for us not to have a series of, like you say, gimmick applications, but have one very simple, holistic experience that lets people take photographs the way that they really would on a normal basis, and have a much better camera experience that way.
Well, the camera is quite a headline on the phone, not least because you're very clearly not following the more megapixels is better route. The latest Sony, the latest Samsung have 13 megapixel sensors. This is a 4 megapixel sensor. Obviously, that means you can have bigger pixels that can grab light more accurately, more effectively. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that design evolved?
This idea of the lower megapixel count has been in our heads for a long time, and we just felt like the time was right now to implement the technology. People are ready to receive that message. People understand and care enough about photography to understand the importance of low light versus participating in the megapixel count. So I think a really big part of that was us wanting to get the most light possible so that we can do other things with it. And part of it was coming up with this idea of a Zoe file, which is a 3-second video that you can take every time you take a picture, and lets you put together these beautiful highlight videos at the end. And I think so that was just as important as the ability to do sequence shots and things like that that really take advantage of the low light capability. I was pragmatic enough to understand that we couldn't really remove the flash because it's one of those line items that needs to be there. But at the same time, we have such a great low-light camera, and I certainly recommend to anybody not to use the flash because the quality is much superior that you can achieve with in most situations just without a flash. So in a way, it would have been a nice statement about the quality of our sensor to just remove the flash.
It's had amazing reviews, but it hasn't yet sold in the numbers that it was perhaps hoped it would. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of factors that I probably can't speak to specifically, but in essence, I think it just is a momentum in the industry that is very hard to turn around in general. Once a brand has established itself in people's minds, especially those people who are not the aficionados like us who read and breathe this every day, I think they walk in the store and they sort of have this default behavior that is very much influenced by the ads they see, the number of ads. And so I think HTC is having to be really smart about the sort of messaging they put out there, but you know, she has to pick the battles as well, because the marketing budgets aren't as big as the competitors. So I think that's going to be the main reason is still the marketing's coming up to speed, and the name sort of has to spread more still.
Sure.
As far as becoming really a household name. In the UK is actually quite good, but I think in the rest of Europe and Asia, it's not quite there yet.
That was Claude Zellweger, creative director at HTC, talking to our technology correspondent, David Phelan, in London there. You're listening to Section D. When it comes to architecture, homewares and furniture, Finland is revered for its clean and clever designs. Names like Alvar Aalto, Artek and Itala stand for modernism, quality and refinement. But in the fashion realm, Finland lags far behind its neighbours, Sweden and Denmark, lacking their retail and critical hits, as well as their government's support for the industry. More avant-garde than commercial, somewhere between Eastern European quirk and Scandinavian chic, Finnish fashion is trying to come into its own. A new initiative called Pre-Helsinki aims to support young designers' efforts in the country and present them as an attractive export, ripe for investment. The project kicked off last week in the Finnish capital with a series of showcases and seminars aimed at spreading the word about local talent. Our reporter, Susan Stone, was there to take a look at fashion done Finnish.
Say the words Finnish fashion design. If your mind doesn't draw a complete blank, it will probably summon up the bright prints and boxy shapes of Marimekko, pattern recognition. Watching the massive flowers fly by in the factory, it's easy to believe that last year the company produced 1.5 million meters of their signature fabrics, a number they hope to soon triple through the addition of new machinery. Marimekko was founded in 1951, instantly catching eyes with its graphic design textiles. But things started to really take off 2 years later, when Vuokko Nummasniemi joined the firm. Vuokko is considered Finland's fashion queen, though she was trained to work with ceramics, pottery, and glass. Last week, she curated a miniature fashion show in her lakeside house for a small group of visitors.
I have two girls here. They can show you the first model that I made myself, so you can see what happens in 53, 54.
The models appear clad in cotton dresses that float off the body, punctuated with large dots and imposing stripes. Far from the classic form-fitting 1950s looks with crinolines and corsets, these dresses allowed women to move and work without limitations, while the easy styles made the most of the bold fabrics.
Very simple, but here I took all the forms away and I had only the dresses, very simple and very clean. And I told that the graphic pattern could see better.
European and Hollywood stars bought Vuokko's designs, and Jackie Kennedy famously wore one of her dresses on the cover of Sports Illustrated in 1960. The color blocks and tonal overlaps are reminiscent of Rothko paintings, and her avant-garde aesthetic has inspired a number of designers, including Issey Miyake and Yoji Yamamoto. But at 83, Vuokko still remains one of Finland's few recognizable fashion names. And Marimekko remains one of the only places in Finland for young designers to hone their craft. The country has no big fashion brands or mass retail giants such as H&M or Zara. That's limiting for rising stars like Satu Marinen. She took home the top prize from the prestigious Hiera design competition last month for nature-inspired prints she formed into an innovative homage to classic couture. Marinen has worked at Marimekko for the last 2.5 years while studying, but she's ready to move on.
It has been my dream since I was a child that maybe someday I could go and work for a big fashion house. Nowadays, it's not that big thing for me, but of course it would be nice to at least try.
Well, can you have that kind of success and stay in Finland?
Through Marimekko, it's not enough. I think I would have to start my own label and then just go abroad with it, like straight away to sell abroad and show always abroad, because we are so far away, so small.
It's not just that there aren't enough companies to train in, says Satu Marinen. There's little recognition for the field itself within Finland.
I feel that there hasn't been respect for fashion, only for design, architecture and like furniture design and those things. But I feel that fashion has been, well, yeah, they don't take it so seriously, even we are so in so high level.
So sometimes it seems like the only way up is out. That's something Heikki Salonen knows firsthand. He left Finland immediately after school, going on to attend the Royal College of Art in London, win several awards, and work for design label Erdem. He's now head designer for Diesel Female, traveling between their offices in Italy and Helsinki, where he's continuing work on a signature line, presented tonight against a backdrop of improvised music.
I think we are very bad exporting, and even worse, we are the worst PR for ourselves as possible. I don't know why it has happened like this, but maybe we always want to be underground. And if you do something ever a little bit commercially, you are like, come on, he's sold his soul completely. I think we are kind of just scared of being out there in a way. But I think that's changing with young Finns' minds.
So you're afraid of selling out?
I'm not.
But no one's really been there to buy. And that's something the new government-funded pre-Helsinki initiative wants to change. Finland currently exports about 700 million euros worth of clothing, textiles and leather goods a year, about half the amount exported by neighboring country Sweden. Finland has no fashion council and no history of support for the textile industry. Growth won't happen without help, says pre-Helsinki's Mia Koski.
Finland has been all about IT and technology, and now it's the gaming industry, which is really big, and a lot of money is going into that. The startup money and business angels are financing that sector very heavily. But yeah, we need to convince the financiers also that fashion can be a good business and it needs support.
For some, the idea has come too late.
Yeah, what we have here is a Mini Efronia bankruptcy exhibition. And the theme is bankruptcy of one Finnish fashion label.
This exhibit at Helsinki's Design Museum charts the downfall of the small fashion label started by Minni Suova and Anna Tuunros through framed rejection letters, racks of unordered clothing samples, and a donation jar. Mini Efronia only survived 3 years, but Suova says it was worth the bitter end.
I have to say that I recommend failure in a sense, because it means that you've tried and then you're much wiser in the future and now you can do it better. There will be always some level of failure, yeah. And then the success is not probably measured in those scales. Like, it has to do something with what you have learned and then what comes out of it.
Suova and Tuunros say they're not giving up for good and hope to keep collaborating. But by losing their label, they've already made their mark. Mini Efronia designs are some of the few pieces of clothing to hang in the National Design Museum, which, like the country, tends to put its focus on architecture, housewares, and furniture. For Monocle, I'm Susan Stone.
Thank you very much, Susan. Next up on Section D, we'll be attending a wonderful exhibition in London of French craftspeople, all employed by Hermès. That's after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back to Section D. The Festival des Métiers, Hermès rolling live craft tour, arrived at London's Saatchi Gallery last week. It offered visitors a glimpse into its ateliers. The exhibition provided an insight into the traditions and values of Hermès in the crafting of fine objects. Monocle's Tim Anscombe-Bell visited the show to meet the artisans and witnessed the creation of some of the house's more iconic pieces too.
With a uniquely creative spirit that blends precision manufacturing with traditional craftsmanship, Hermès has stood as purveyor of luxury goods, or as they call it, beaux objets, for over 175 years. I'm at the Saatchi Gallery in West London to discover their version of a luxury arts and crafts fair, the Festival des Métiers. Walking into the exhibition, we're greeted by a light and playful pop-up set by designer Paola Navone. There's very little branding here, and certainly no attempt to sell scarves or bags, but the display is unmistakably Hermès. It feels like the stuff of school trips, as the various craftspeople work leather, paint ceramics, and screen print silk, as are handbags, scarves, and fine jewellery that form some of the French brand's most iconic pieces come to life before our eyes.
Hi, I'm Claire-Marie. I'm a sellier maroquinier, which is a laser craft person for Hermès. I'm working now on a handbag called the Gypsier. It's in thorium clémence and bleu de mal color. Its design was created by Jean-Paul Gaultier when he was artistic director of the company. So I'm working on the front of the bag for the moment, and I will set up the swivel clasp, the little hooks on both sides.
What effect do you think the Festival des Métiers has on the public's perception of your craft?
It's important, first of all, for craftsmen to meeting customers and in both sides. It's an exchange. The idea is, of course, sharing our craftsmanship, our techniques, and showing them that for everything is handmade with a lot of care and love. So that's it. Passionate people.
So Claire-Marie has just explained to me that all craftspeople starting out with the house are trained for their first 12 months in the basics of their discipline. Those who work with leather are taught the fundamentals of shape, along with saddle stitching and polishing of the iconic Hermès H's.
After 1 year, you work in a production workshop, always with a tutor who will take care of you to teach you the best techniques, how to make it quicker, nicer, always improving your techniques until you get totally comfortable with your skills. So we say you need to have like around 3 years experience to have the Hermès hands, and you're still improving all your working life, definitely.
I'm going to have a chat with Kamal Amadou, who is in charge of communications for the silk workshops in Lyon, where all the Hermès scarves are made.
We print the Hermès scarf in Lyon since 1937. And we use the traditional way of printing. It's called the Lyonnaise technique. So we have improved on 70 years. We have improved the technique. At the beginning, we use a wood block. So we have to engrave 4 blocks for one color. Then we use a big frame on wood on which we stretch the silk. And then after World War II, we use a steel frame on which we stretch the nylon of the parachute. And today, since 50 years, it's a polyester mesh. That's why on more than 70 years we have improved this technique.
And some of the silk scarves are incredibly intricate. How long does it take from designing of the pattern to create one of the scarves in full?
So in fact it's a long process. For me, the Hermès scarf is like a chain of métier. You have different links. At each link you have a knowledge, a savoir-faire. Okay, so the story of the scarf started by a design. Then the second step is the engraver. Then we have the weaver. We have the colorist, the printer. Then the finishing touch, the fixing, washing, drying, finishing touch, and hand hemming. So if we add the time for each link from the design to the boutique, we need more than 2 years.
To make one scarf.
So one sometimes I see on some duty free when we sell the scarf in 2 minutes, for us we need 2 years. That's amazing.
We now have Mr. Bertrand Michaud, Managing Director of Hermès in the UK. I'm going to speak to Mr. Michaud about what the festival means to the house.
I think that Hermès was created in 1837, and the company has never been in a hurry. We always took time. We gave time to everything. And we are not overexposed. We are not underexposed. We still do the same things and the same objects. We create them with passion, with time as well. And at the end of the day, when you are very consistent with quality, creativity, craftsmanship, I think our friends, our customers, they know what they're buying. And they know that they're buying objects which will be of a good use, good companion for themselves, but also for their children in a way. And the good point of the Festival des Métiers is that it's very accessible to everyone. You can speak with the craftsmen, you can ask them their questions. There is no press release, there is no barrier. You can just speak with them freely and ask them what they do, which is, I think it's a good opportunity, good chance.
And do you see that transparency being increasingly important to the luxury market today? Is that something that people search out for, something they look for?
In a way, but you said it, but I really think it's very important to go beyond marketing, to go beyond advertising, and to come back to the roots of what we are doing. Hermès is not only a brand, it's also a signature.
Mr. Michaud, like a number of those here today, has been with the company for over 20 years. He explains how the working environment and love of their craft is what creates employee allegiance to the house.
What I define as luxury is really to go to the office every morning with pleasure. It's a true luxury in life. It's not an object. It's not owning a car or a beautiful castle or whatever. It's really, we have to work. So we work. And I think that a lot of employees in this company go to the office with pleasure or to the workshop with pleasure. And it explains the loyalty. And when you do something with pleasure, you do it well. And if you do it well, the customers knows it and feels it and understand.
For Monocle, at the Saatchi Gallery in London, I'm Tim Anscombe-Bell.
That was our Tim Anscombe-Bell reporting there in London. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, IDEO is one of the world's more progressive design agencies. With offices all over the world, the studio does far more than focus on just making beautiful things. It works to make things better, across the board, from the little things in life right up to the way businesses run. Concurrent to their daily work at IDEO, the agency runs a project called Designs On. It's part brainstorm, part workshop, part research project that dissects a different topic each time and explores the possible future. The latest Designs On took packaging as its theme, and I spoke with Blaise Bertrand, Industrial Design Director at IDEO in Palo Alto, who looked after the project.
What Designs On is, it's a global innovation platform that pushes the edge of design by presenting, we believe, forward-thinking provocations by, you know, IDEO designers around topics such as, you know, food, global warming, packaging. It started in 2008 as an internal effort, and it quickly gained a lot of momentum within the global IDEO community.
And so packaging is the latest one. I'm wondering how you decided to choose packaging as a theme.
So the packaging is actually the fifth of the series, Hugo. And the way we usually select themes for Designs are based on three aspects. The first one is, what are the important topics out in the world that we want to start experimenting with and pushing the edge of? The second one is, I would say, internally, which is, what are the designers' passions and how can we explore these passions in an experimental way? And the third aspect is, we have domains at IDEO that we want to deepen, and that's a factor of that. So I think the packaging in particular was at the convergence of these three aspects.
And what do you hope to achieve by the project? You explained there that it's a convergence of these three different motives for you to settle on a subject like packaging, but is it really just a great big analysis of one area of life, or does it form the beginning of a future sort of discussion that you have with the various companies that you work with, getting them to think a little bit closer about packaging, for instance, here?
Right. I think that's a bit of both, really. The first aspect, I would say, is to reveal and explore new opportunities in a pretty mature content area, right? And that's something that we like doing as well, is saying, hey, you know, there's a lot of things out there. But we very often feel that packaging can have a negative connotation because of its impact on the environment. So what we wanted to do here is to say, okay, let's take this and let's see if we can reveal emotional connections with users and impact this area in a slightly different way.
And so how do you approach the project then? Do you work with the different IDEO offices around the world and ask them to pick an area of the packaging industry to explore it a little deeper?
That is correct. So very much so. In this particular case, it was a global effort. So we picked a brief, and the intent of Design Zone is to have a very concise brief to let designers and to let our locations to define it the way they want to do it. So we communicate the brief to all of our locations and all of our designers, and they structure it the way they want to do it. We treat it as a project, so we have a global coordinator, if you will, someone who's able to share and to make sure that we share and we build on ideas of others. We have a deadline, and we have a very light process around design reviews and building a culture of critique within that effort. We also build a blog, an internal blog, where people can share inspiration and share their ideas. And once we all have that body of work, then we select, each location select their best concepts, and we create a point of view under the umbrella of this brochure and a website.
And so talk us through a few of the examples of the works that have emerged from the designs on packaging through the project.
So there are two concepts that we found that are very representative of Design Zone and also really creative and innovative around packaging. These two projects that I'm going to share are strong also because they embrace human qualities, right? So the first one is the synthetic biology one that was conceived in the Bay Area. And the intent there is to explore this area of synthetic biology and biology in general by leveraging some sort of bacteria that would be attracted to light. And once it's attracted to light, it would form an object, in this particular case, a cup, would solidify. And when people start using it and pouring water into it and drinking it, it would release a particular quality, like a probiotic or something like this. I think this project, this concept is interesting because, as I said, it's an area that is unexplored. It's an area where design, we know design will play a big role in the future. So let's start the conversation there. The second concept that I'd like to share is the expired concept. And if we look at the world of medical packaging and medication bottle in particular, we realize it's a very complex object. It's very often hard for users to read and to understand the expiration date. So in this particular case, what the team did in Chicago was to use an analogy of nature and as a reference, as a point of inspiration, and leverage it to create a new packaging. For instance, if you think about a banana there, it's very clear to understand when the banana is expiring, essentially, right? So really looking at the inspiration and the graphic elements that shows that and putting it on the packaging so that people can clearly understand when it's expiring.
So to be clear, the IDEO team in Chicago, they looked at the banana that goes from yellow to brown when the banana is rotten, and they developed a packaging concept for medicine that would start off clear and then become brown by the end when it was time to throw it away?
That is absolutely correct, yeah. And what we've noticed is that, of course, expiration date is usually written with, you know, in small fonts on packaging, and it doesn't fit with a lot of people. So having a very clear cue of what it is the goal of this concept.
Very interesting indeed. Tell me, does the project, I mean, you've highlighted a project there that seems something that could definitely be applied to everyday life and maybe not too far into the future. Do many of these projects have a life beyond simply just exploring what the future could be like?
Yes, absolutely. And I think what we love about Design Zone is the aspect of inspiring and starting a dialogue with both our clients and the larger design community, right? That's really what it is. It's the start of a dialogue. I think these concepts and this project encourages us as well to push the edge of this content and to start applying our learnings in other areas as well. And the third aspect I would say is exploring our passion and see how far we want to, you know, go there. And the final aspect I would say is forming individual perspectives. It's beautiful to see designers having a very clear sense of expression and storytelling. And when you see the completion of this, it forms a collective point of view that we found will have legs and generate an interesting dialogue.
That was Blaise Bertrand, Industrial Design Director at IDEO, talking to me there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Fear not, we'll be back next week talking to legendary architect Charles Corrier. We'll be looking at bamboo bike frames in Germany, and we'll take a tour of some tropical modernist masterpieces in Accra too. So do tune in then. Today's show was produced by Alid John and edited by James Bacon. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, in anticipation of our trip down to Accra next week, here's Africa by Toto.